today, in this series that we are doing in these cafes on pilgrimage, I'm delighted that Azim Jiraj has joined us. Azim and I have been colleagues and friends, a couple decades, I guess. I've appreciated him so very much, and he's, of course, been engaged substantial amount of the work of the Ronning Center, and has been a supporter and a good colleague in that work. Azim is a natural intellectual. It's a lovely thing to be. That's what I am, sort of a natural intellectual. As long as you don't understand natural in the 19th century use of the term. Except in my case, it may be right to understand it that way. Azim is an active member of the Ismaili community in Edmonton. He's an African, which you can tell just by looking at him. And part of that long migration, the British colonial movement, as well as other colonial movements, had a great benefit of bringing people from various parts of the world to Africa. And then African nationalism, for its many benefits, one of them is, it's a tragedy in many ways as well, but one of them is to bring particularly so many people from the Ismaili community to Canada and to enrich Canada in a remarkable way. So we have been talking together and we're doing a work together, really a kind of memoir of the journey that he's going to open for you today. It is a remarkable journey in a number of ways to my mind. One is the extraordinary leadership of the Aga Khan, the head of the Ismaili community, the Imam of the day. And also, I must say, the hair on the back of my neck rarely stands on end. But as I listened to Azim talk about what happened in those very short weeks where his community had to migrate en masse out of Uganda, and to the role of our government in that, and our diplomatic service in that, I must admit, I treasure Canada, but you know, like most Canadians, it's not often vivid. We have the luxury of it being unvivid. But listening to that dimension of the story deepened my regard for our country as well. So I'm delighted you're here and that we have a chance to listen to you and then talk with you.
Well, thank you, David. I'm going to start by giving a little background into the history of the Asian community. I'm going to use the word Asian, really meaning East Indians, but in East Africa, we were known as Asians. The British were known as Europeans, and then there were the Africans. So we were divided into three groups. So
let me challenge my, right off the bat, the fact that I turned you into an African.
Well,
you have to appreciate the people here are very partial to Africans.
I want you to imagine a little village in India in the 1800s.
Can you all hear okay? You can move a little closer.
Imagine a young man, about 15 years old, getting ready for a trip to Africa. In Europe, the source of River Nile was not yet known. Burton, Livingston, Stanley, and Speke had not yet traveled to East Africa. What would this young man pack for his trip? He would certainly take all his worldly belongings, which would probably be two or three pairs of clothing that he owned. He would certainly take the memory of his village. He would take the memory of his family and friends. He would take the stories from his village. He would take a few seeds in the hope of growing some familiar food to the new continent he's going to. And he would take his religion, his rites, and his rituals with him. Because his religion was going to be his companion on this journey to the dark continent. And he would have a name of a contact person that was going to give him some word when he got to Africa. He would have packed all this in a piece of cloth that would be tied, and then he would do his first part of the journey. He would leave his village and travel to the port city, Porbandar, Gandhi's town, from where he would get on a boat to either Mombasa or Dar es Salaam. He would have paid very little fare, and therefore part of his fare would be working on the boat to get there. The journey, of course, had many challenges. But once he arrived in Mombasa, he would have been met by an Ismaili who would have received him and taken him to the Jamaat Khana. Jamaat Khana is our place of worship. Jamaat Khana literally means house of congregation. But this is where this 15-year-old would get a meal, a place to wash, and a place to rest. He'd be allowed to stay there till accommodation would be found. Either the same day or within a couple of days, he would meet his contact and start work, whatever work was assigned to him. This 15-year-old has left his home, left his family, all alone in this place. What kind of trade was happening in the 1800s from East Africa? Well, the export was still, the largest export was slaves, animal skins, feathers, those kinds of things were being sent to the Middle East, to Europe, and in return, all kinds of goods that could be sold in East Africa were being brought. Now, the East Indians had traveled with the Arabs for many centuries to Africa. But the first record of settlement we have of an East Indian in East Africa is in the early 1800s. After the explorers came to East Africa, Christian missionaries started to arrive in East Africa. And with the missionaries came a few soldiers, came a few administrators, and pretty soon East Africa was claimed by the Europeans as their country. Kenya became a British protectorate, and Kenya became a British colony, and Tanzania became German East Africa. At the same time, once this became a British colony, India was also a British colony, and people from India now were being brought to East Africa to build roads, buildings, and the big thing was the railway. So a lot of Indians were being brought to East Africa. At this time, the Imam of the Ismailis, the grandfather of the current Aga Khan, encouraged Ismailis who were living in Kutch, part of Gujarat, to move to East Africa. For those of you who don't know about Kutch, Kutch over the last 50 years has become a desert. And, you know, there would have been no livelihood for this community had they stayed behind. So the community was encouraged to move to East Africa. It was very difficult for the community to move, to give up what you had, and it was the men who moved first, like this 15-year-old. Community starts to move to East Africa, and the first large Jamaat Khana is built in Mombasa in 1890. This Jamaat Khana still stands and is still being used by the community in Mombasa. It still is the largest Jamaat Khana in Mombasa. In the early 1900s, the community now started to move into Uganda. There were better opportunities in Uganda. Uganda had two quite sophisticated kingdoms. One was the Buganda Kingdom and one was the Kingdom of Toro. The British missionaries also went, and Uganda also became part of the British colony. From the early 1900s till Uganda got independence in 1962, from no outsiders going into Uganda, within a period of 60 years, Kampala looked like a modern city in 1962 when Uganda got independence. We had hydropower, we had 25, 30-story buildings there. We had a world-class university. We had hundreds of schools. The school system during the British time was divided into three different school systems. There was a school for the Europeans, where only Europeans could go. No Asians or Africans could go to that school. There were schools for Asians, which were again divided. There was a school for the Ismailis, the Aga Khan schools. There were schools for the Hindus. And then there were schools for other Asians. And the African schools were run by the church. So you had the Anglicans running schools and you had the Catholics running schools. So we had three separate school systems. After independence, most of the Europeans left Uganda. And so we were left with two separate school systems, the Asian school system and the African school system. And of course, these systems could not be integrated overnight. When Uganda got independence, the Ismaili community gave up their British passports and took on Uganda citizenship. There were a few people. The total Asian population of Uganda in 1962 was about 50,000. A few people left when Uganda got independence, but most stayed behind. We had a good civilian government, and for the next 5 to 7 years after independence, there was a lot of prosperity in the country. Schools were getting better. Thousands of African kids were going to school. University was doing exceptionally well. The civil service was doing good. The judiciary and all that. You know, the Africans were getting into everything, except the political system. The prime minister of the day, Milton Obote, was very popular the first 3 years of his term, but then he wasn't as popular and wanted to stay in office forever. So the next election, people believed, was rigged. but he continued on as the Prime Minister for the second term. He was quite unpopular, and he thought to become more popular, he got rid of the King of Buganda. And then the next thing he did in 1969 was nationalize all businesses owned by Asians. So 40% of everything we owned overnight belonged to the government. This, for the first few days, among the Africans, seemed like a very popular thing. But after a while, they began to realize that it didn't change anything for them. And even for the government, the 40% nationalizing meant having to hire far more bureaucrats to come and audit our businesses, in which really they did not have the ability to do. However, in 1971, there was a military coup in Uganda, and a fellow by the name of Idi Amin Dada took over. For the first 60 days of him taking over, he was very popular because they'd got rid of Obote. He gave everybody back their properties, and things seemed that they may improve and a civilian government would soon come in. Except on about day 61 of his power, said, "I had a dream in which God told me that only citizens should live in Uganda. And everybody who was not a citizen of Uganda would have to leave within 90 days. So out of the almost 50,000 Asians that were there, about 25,000 were not citizens of Uganda. They had decided either to keep their British passports or their Indian or Pakistani or some other country's passports. So we knew that these people would have to leave. And there was already enough chaos and panic within the country that if you got rid of half of your people who really controlled most of the economy of the country, this was your business class that controlled the economy. Lineups at the British High Commission, people would line up for a day or two, stay in lines all night, because the High Commission would only open at 9 o'clock in the morning, close for lunch at 12, reopen at 1:30, and close at 3:30 for the day. And they had 25,000 people to process. They didn't want to take these 25,000 people to Britain. They didn't want them there. But they had no choice. So they were trying to delay this, and they were hoping that Idi Amin would change his mind. Well, day 31 into this 90 days, Amin says he had another dream in which God told him Uganda must be only black. So even all the colored citizens of the country must leave within this 90-day period. And of course we said, sure enough, the international community would not allow this. How can citizens of a country be kicked out of a country? Well, we were very wrong in thinking that, because around day 40, the U.S. Embassy had a full-page ad in the newspaper saying, "We will take 100 engineers with this qualification and give them visas to go to the U.S. And we knew if the U.S. was not going to stand behind, no other country was going to support this. So now there was real panic. We have 50 days. We are citizens of Uganda, but we are told to pack our bags and leave. Where do we go? Britain doesn't want us because they have to take the 25,000 people. So all kinds of countries came. Some of the Norwegian countries came and said, we'll take 100 people. India, Pakistan came and said, we'll take a couple thousand people. And there was real panic because where do we go? My father was born there. I was born there. My grandfather came there in 1904. This was our country. At that time, the Aga Khan, the current Aga Khan, who was a good friend of the Prime Minister then was Pierre Trudeau, approached the Canadian Prime Minister and asked him to take a few thousand Asians from Uganda and bring them to Canada. Now, till this point, Canada had never done anything like this. So we're now day 45, and the Canadian government makes an announcement that they will take 5,000 people from Uganda and bring them to Canada. Immediately, Canada had no high commission in Uganda. As soon as that announcement is made, within 48 hours, a temporary high commission is set up in Uganda, in Kampala, and a full page ad in the newspaper says, our high commission will open tomorrow morning at 7 o'clock in the morning. And of course, we all thought this was a typo because all the high commissions and embassies opened at 9. But since we were, you know, accustomed to lining up in the middle of the night, we went and lined up. And sure enough, at 7 o'clock in the morning, the doors opened. Not only that, they had chairs outside for people to sit on. And when it was 12 o'clock, they didn't close their doors. They kept working till about 8 or 9 every night. Now, when the Canadian people, the High Commission opened and the immigration people came there, they came with a set of rules, what kind of people we want. And these rules were how to take a regular immigrant in, not refugees, but a regular immigrant. So the first few people who went through the interviews had to have some university qualification or had to have money. Now, of course, since we were leaving the country, none of us had any money. All the money was in Uganda. We couldn't take it with us. We were not allowed to. So, and medicals had to be done on everyone. Well, as days went along, or hours really, the immigration people, and there were two people, there was a fellow by the name of St. Vincent and his assistant Mike Malloy. These two people started to make decisions as they went along and said, this is not practical. In 40 days, we're not going to be able to process 5,000 people. And they started changing the rules and accepting people, and even the medical restrictions were dropped. Within those 40 days that the Canadian High Commission was there, they managed to process 5,000 people and bring 5,000 people to Canada. When I went for my immigration interview, it was the whole family together, the immigration officer said, where would you like to go? And most of us could name four places in Canada. Ottawa is the capital. Montreal then was the largest city in Canada. Toronto was the second largest city. And we knew Vancouver. So he said, you can't go to Montreal. You don't speak any French. And he says, we're not taking anybody for Ottawa. And he says, Toronto and Vancouver are full. There is no more room there. So we're going to send you to a place called Edmonton. So, No, not token. So we said, great. Went home, opened the atlas, and looked where Edmonton was. And the next day when we went to collect our visas, he said, and make sure you take a few sweaters. It's a little cold there. Now, we'd grown up in the tropics, never seen snow before, and we land here in middle of November. We land in Montreal, and there is snow on the ground, and it is very, very cold. As soon as we landed there, all of us were given brand new winter coats and boots. The Aga Khan's grandmother had made them available for all of us. From there, we took a plane to Edmonton. When we landed here, there was a group of people from the church who came to receive us. Provided accommodation, well, took us first and, you know, gave us a hot meal and all that. Now remember, we're coming from Africa, where when the British ruled, the white man was superior. And, you know, you never crossed their path, you never annoyed them, you did what you were told. It was a very different world. And now we were coming to a country of white people. It was quite scary as to what our position in this country is going to be. Well, soon we, after being here a couple of days, we said, you know, we need to find some work. Because when we came, just the trip from where I lived in Fort Portal, which is 200 miles from the airport, all we were allowed to bring with us was one suitcase each. And in this suitcase, you would kind of pack your clothes and you would pack some pictures and things like that. Well, every 20 miles, there was a military checkpoint. At the first checkpoint, they opened your bags and took whatever they wanted. At the second checkpoint, they took more stuff out. By the time we got to the last checkpoint, all we had was empty suitcases. And so most of us, a lot of us, came with just the clothes we were wearing and nothing else. We come here, it's time to go to work. So you start applying for jobs. And every place you go for an interview, you're asked, do you have any Canadian experience? And you say, I just told you I've been here 2 days. I have no Canadian experience. So if you were an architect with 10, 15 years experience, you got a job as a draftsman. And everybody was employed way below what they should have been employed for. But within 3 months, they began to realize the potential of everyone, and most of us were promoted to better jobs than what we were originally applying for. When we first moved here, the first thing we wanted to do was to set up a Jamaat Khana, a place for worship. Because that, in an Ismaili's life, is the center of everything. Jamaat Khana is a place where you go to pray. Jamaat Khana is a place where you celebrate other people's successes. Jamaat Khana is a place where you hear about other people's misfortunes and try and help people. But everything for an Ismaili revolves around the Jamaat Khana. So when few of us arrived here, Jamaat Khana was set up at Amir Suleiman, who had been here a few weeks before we had arrived, at his house. when the Ugandans came, his house was not big enough. So at Park Plaza in Edmonton, there used to be a school. And that's where we went and rented the gym to have Friday, Saturday, Sunday prayers. And it was quite interesting. There used to be a bus, S1 and S2, that went by Park Plaza. And as soon as we would get on the bus with a plate of food offering, the bus driver would say, "Are you going to your place of worship?" And we'd say, "Yes." He says, "Do you know where it is?" We say, "Well, this is the address." He says, "I'll show you exactly where it is." And he would stop the bus in between two bus stops and point to the building and say, "That's where it is." We arrived, we were 75 Ismailis here in 1972. Because of our successes at place of work, we were 5,000 across Canada. Other relatives and family members and friends who had gone to now Britain or other places, we started telling them our success stories. We were able to sponsor them to come to Canada. And pretty soon, the community here grew from 75 to 750 people, and today we're about 4,500 Ismailis in Edmonton. Today we have three Jamaat Khanas in Edmonton. One purpose-built Jamaat Khana. Purpose-built really means it was, the building was built from ground up for the purpose of Jamaat Khana. The other two, we had bought buildings and renovated them into Jamaat Khanas. Ismailis today, if you were to look at the 4,500 Ismailis in Edmonton, we've had members of parliament from there. The mayor of Calgary is an Ismaili. We have Ismaili senators. We have several Ismailis who have orders of Canada. But Ismailis working in all kinds of fields, academia, medical field, in the business community is extremely successful. 4,500 Ismailis in Edmonton have created over 20,000 jobs in Edmonton. Half of them white-collar jobs, because there are two very large companies that hire a lot of engineers and computing people. So Canada has been very, very good to the Ismaili community. And the bureaucracy that came was exceptionally good. Since then, in Canada, the community, with the guidance of His Highness the Aga Khan, we have established, well, several Jamaat Khanas across Canada. The first purpose-built large Jamaat Khana was built in Burnaby about almost 30 years ago. We're building a very large Jamaat Khana in Toronto. The Aga Khan Museum is being built in Toronto. One of the things about Canada is the ability that Canada has had, either by design or accident, is how to integrate all these different people from different parts of the world who have come to Canada, make them feel Canadian, and this is a merit-based society. If you look at, if you remember the riots a few years ago in Europe, where in France, thousands of Arabs, university graduates who could not get work, they all lived in one part of town. Whereas in Canada, I can live anywhere. It's all a merit-based society. And the model of pluralism has been extremely successful. So the Aga Khan, with the government of Canada, has set up an institute
called the Institute, the Global Institute of Pluralism. How can we export the Canadian model to the rest of the world to teach them what is it that we do in Canada that works so well? And you send it to other countries. So on that, on the board of that, you know, the people like Kofi Annan, our past Governor General, Adrian Clarkson. So that is something that is going to hopefully in the next little while produce a lot of material where we will even judges from different parts of the world would be able to come here and take a course on some of the things that Canada is so successful at.
Another couple minutes.
Well, actually, I could stop here and answer questions. So,
what do you hear? What would you like to engage?
That's a great story. Kind of makes you feel good.
How familiar were you with it, Peter?
Not at all. Only in passing references that you've made at
different points.
I didn't know the full story.
This morning on CBC, there was a really neat dialogue as I was driving in about Ismaili community and Métis community working together in Edmonton, sharing resources and
difficulties,
challenges, particularly with new immigrants. And we have been thinking for quite a while about the potential because we really know that business community, think to religion. My husband and I have been involved with it in your community for probably 20 years. About the potential of that to form dialogue with our own native people. And it seems to me such useful, has so much potential there. And I wondered if you're familiar with this model and what potential you think it might have.
Well,
because it's interesting if you're talking about export, but what about, you know, cross-fertilization, more your creative?
Through the Aga Khan Foundation, which is a charitable arm of the community, we do a lot of development work around the world, and this development work is mostly done in Asia and Africa. And the model of this development work is you don't tell people what they should have. You go to a village and you find out what is the one thing you could do for the village that would improve the quality of their life. And 9 out of 10 times the answer is, if you can bring water to our village, the quality of our lives would improve. Well, we work with the villagers. We don't send engineers from here to go and build what is needed. We get the villagers involved in working with us to get water to the village. Once they've got water, they can grow more crops. They now need a road to take the crops to the market. And while this is happening, we start working with the women in village, talking about primary health care, talking about the opportunities that if education was brought to the village, what would it do for the children of the village? And pretty soon, we then have the village telling us that we want a little school here, we want health clinics here. And so from the time we get into a village till we are done, it's about a 17 or 18 year commitment till schools are built and everything else is done, and the villages themselves are then able to run everything that has been built. So this is one model that we've been kind of tried to talk with some of the politicians here and said, you know, for the last 40 years, we've seen the Department of Indian Affairs go and do a lot of things, and they've not been very successful. So we have some experience in some of these areas where we could work together with the native community, the government, all of us together, but it has to be their initiative. It can't be us imposing things, because that's what we've been doing for the last 40 years and it hasn't worked. So that's the thinking behind some of these programs, but I don't know where it'll go.
What's your thoughts on that, Jim?
My thoughts, I have a few, and I'm
just a few
about work we've been doing through our Association for Lifelike Living with Hobima, and it started at Augustana in the 70s, and so it's got a long, long history. But there are Native leaders who've really been struggling to create new kinds of services, not only on the reserve, but between urban natives and reserve natives. And they run up against terrific, you use the word bureaucratic, impediments. And it seems that the kind of conversation that you're providing, have already done with federal departments and so on, might just be a really new shift in the potential for some new stuff that isn't so laden with all of that old, all those old barnacles that everybody is trying to deal with.
The Canadian government is very involved in a lot of Aga Khan Foundation projects around the world through CEDA. So they have firsthand seen some of the work.
Gail, you've been involved in pretty deeply in these matters. What do you hear here?
I hear a 17, 18-year time frame, which I think is really something that we need to be looking at. In our experience, I've worked with a locally based NGO with very much the same philosophy.
This is an NGO called Sahakarini that's based here.
And we were often frustrated by CEDA saying, 2 or 3 years you're in and you're out, and it
doesn't work.
Be self-sustainable and
doesn't work.
No. And so sometimes we've been able in the past at least to have repeated projects in the same area, and sometimes if it's just water, that's fine, but as you say, it leads to other things.
Mm-hmm.
I think we need to be looking much longer term, definitely locally initiated, but perhaps facilitated.
Right.
But the time frames have been much too short, and the expectations were rather harsh, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So that was what jumped out at me to me and what you said.
Have you been able, has the foundation been able to figure out how to move CEDA off that 2-3 year dime?
No.
I didn't hear your question.
Has the Aga Khan Foundation been able to move CEDA off the sort of 2-3 year time frame and get them involved in thinking in a longer way, a longer time frame?
No. The whole Department of Indian Affairs, there is so much politics in there that, you know, for the longest time, none of these ideas were even being listened to. It is just in the last little while that people are beginning to listen to some of these ideas and saying, maybe that's what we need. You know, we need the commitment of the people in the village, and they need to feel that these are their projects, these are their priorities. And if we work that way, so it's just, you know, the dialogue is just starting to happen now.
When you do a project, and I'll go back to see it because it's what I know.
Yeah.
There's always a section called Lessons Learned.
Can you speak a little louder?
Yes.
There's always a section in your reports called Lessons Learned, and you can write all you want, but it may go to one department and doesn't ever see the light of day anywhere else, and how can that be made to happen?
That's right.
It's a model that I think we need to be thinking about sustainability in our own country. As we can learn from the work that we try to do internationally, it applies here equally well. So
it does, yes.
And I think that the Aga Khan Foundation may have the heft to be heard. I hope so.
Yeah, we're hoping, you know, that because this way we're able to do things locally, you know, rather than just doing them in the developing world. And there is a need. You know, there's a real need to do that work.
Mm-hmm. What's been the trigger that has enabled Aga Khan Foundation to fund the bureaucracy a bit? Open the door a bit, as you suggest.
Well, I think it's really, I don't like to use the word failure, but I think our experience over the last 40 years that shows we haven't done as well. And, you know, you can show projects. When Anne McLellan was the Deputy Prime Minister, we took her to a school in northern Pakistan, in Hunza, which was built 14 years ago. This is a girls' school. And when she went in the classrooms there and looked outside the windows, she first thought she was in somewhere in Switzerland. These classrooms had furniture like the best schools anywhere in the West. They had computers and everything else. Kids were reading the New York Times and the Observer and things like that. And, you know, they were fluent in English. Three of the kids that Anne McLellan met have made it to Ivy League schools in the U.S. And, you know, 40 miles out of that village, the literacy rate in this village was 97%. 40 miles out of that village, the literacy rate was less than 3%. So where you start working in this places, you can actually provide the very best in the world.
So are you saying that one of the things the Aga Khan Foundation has done is it has made a, you use the word heft, a, or use the word heft, a substantial contribution over time.
That's right.
So that actually a model has developed.
Yes.
To say, you know, this can be done differently.
This can,
and
yep.
So then you bring Anne McLellan, you can bring the politicians there and say, look,
yep.
With this substantive contribution over time, you can actually do something.
That's right.
This 2-3 year stuff
is
a failure.
It doesn't work.
Look at this.
Yeah.
Time.
Yeah.
And so you've done enough of it. The foundation's done enough in enough places around the world
that
you're now starting to bring politicians there, as well as university people there, and saying, here's a different model.
That's right.
The model you're speaking of is also exemplified in the Stephen Lewis Foundation.
That's right.
Very much the grassroots model.
Yes.
Has. It's relatively a new foundation compared to
yep.
the Khan Foundation. Of course, it only started in 2003. But the success to date of that foundation has been because of the grassroots
yes.
initiatives and identification of need, and thus the funding. Is there much relationship? Is there any? Are there areas where the Stephen Lewis Foundation is in the 15th sub-Saharan
country?
How much is there some evidence of collaboration between the Aga Khan Foundation and the Stephen Lewis Foundation in some of those areas?
No, none that I know of.
Okay.
Because and the Lewis Foundation mostly works with people with AIDS. And we do full development, kind of,
okay.
you know, so slightly different.
You're not doing triage.
No.
Okay.
Both need to be done.
That's right.
But they are different.
When the Aga Khan went to the Prime Minister of Canada to bring people from Uganda, how much of it was based on personality and how much on government? Like, for example, if it had happened today and Aga Khan had gone to speak to our current Prime Minister, would it turn out the same or have we changed our political policy?
Well, two things. I think the Aga Khan and the Prime Minister at that time, Pierre Trudeau, they knew each other. And
they rode horses together.
Probably. Well, when Pierre Trudeau died, Aga Khan was one of the pallbearers at his funeral. So they had this relationship, and because of this relationship, I think what happened happened so quickly. Because, you know, it had to be done in days. You couldn't talk about this thing and go to the cabinet, and you had to, you know, a decision had to be made right now that we're going to help these people.
It was a triage situation.
Yeah. Look, you know, there is no time, and we need to fly our people tomorrow morning to Kampala.
So that speaks to part of it, but there's another implication in this, which has to do with the current prime minister.
Well,
the prime minister at the time would have felt that the mood of the government of the people of Canada with multiculturalism was supporting this sort of idea. Is that happening today? If he'd gone through with Stephen Harper today, would Stephen Harper been able to make the same decisions quickly and know that the people of Canada were behind it?
Maybe there.
Well, knowing what Stephen Harper knows today about at least the Ismaili community, about, you know, the success of the Vietnamese community that has been there, I think that would be supportive. Now, strictly based on ideology, I don't know, but, you know, the experience of the immigrant communities coming to Canada has been very positive.
But just to follow up on that, can you say a little bit about your sense as someone who works obviously in the Ismaili community as well and its various agencies, your sense of the need to build relationship across ideology, to build relationship across political parties, and to do it in a somewhat different register? Could you speak about that a little bit?
I mean, we have extremely good relationships with Stephen Harper. We may not support the ideology or whatever, but we have good relationships because it is important for all the work that has to be done around the world that you have good relationships with whoever the government of Canada is, because the work is important. So you always work with the government. New government comes in, you go meet them, you sit down with them, you tell them what is it that you're doing, talk of all the past support that has been there. You talk of how people appreciate that in the developing world. You know, why are thousands of people lining up in all our embassies around the world wanting to come to Canada? Because they've seen some of the work that we do around the world. And they like what they see about Canada.
Do you want to follow up on that?
I'm just wondering, when I was younger, I know multiculturalism was talked a lot about. And then over the years, it's been sort of kicked around a bit as not succeeding. I'm wondering what you see the point, what you see the mood today.
Well, I think the European experience has been, it hasn't succeeded. But the Europeans have done a lot of things wrong. You have Turks living in Germany, third generation, who can't become citizens of that country. Now, that's a big problem. Whereas in Canada,
the whole guest worker notion.
You know, I became a citizen, you know, in those days it was 5 years. Within 5 years, as soon as my 5 years were up, I wanted to become a citizen. I became a citizen. The way in which this country has worked and developed this idea, I think in Canada it's been very successful, the idea of multiculturalism. And we're now moving into the concept of pluralism. Right? From multiculturalism to pluralism, because multiculturalism worked and it's done with. But now we need to expand this thinking into also different religious groups and, you know, learning to understand each other better. Not just tolerate, I mean, I may not like you, but I tolerate you, but here is a real understanding of each other and appreciation of each other. And I think that's where we're moving into as Canadians.
It's so interesting. You know, ideologically, one might think one thing about Harper, but if you analyze, even if you analyze the last election, and if you look at Minister Kenney, where has Minister Kenney spent his time?
That's right.
He spent the vast majority of his time romancing so-called ethnic communities to
the Harper government's policy and orientation, I think you might be able to argue, like statistically, that in fact what had been the Liberal Party's sort of hegemony with these communities has shifted. The last election was won not because of white folks who vote conservative. It was won because of the Asian community, Chinese community, Sikh community, primarily in Ontario and in BC, primarily because of Jason Kenney's preoccupations and his way of going after that. Now, I would argue you need to do a more textured analysis of that as well. You need to look at how are they shifting immigration policy, how are they shifting who is acceptable in the country and what have you, and what part of those communities have become the privileged part for Canadian citizenship. And that's kind of an interesting story in and of itself. But it's not as... I mean, this landscape has really shifted in the last 5 years, it seems to me.
There's a session coming up in, I think, maybe a couple of weeks or shorter, that Chester Ronning is doing in Edmonton on reasonable accommodation, like what are the limits of it. And I'm wondering what the experience of your community has been in being allowed to... I shouldn't say allowed, but feeling comfortable in retaining some of your religious and ethnic identity in Canadian culture.
Well, with the religious identity, we've been able to retain everything and with all the freedoms to practice. With the religious identity, we've been able to retain everything that we want with the freedoms that this country allows. As far as culture goes, I think culture is ever moving. It's shifting. You know, culture keeps changing. So, you know, what used to be a typical East Indian culture in India when my grandfather left, by the time we were in Uganda, that culture, a lot of things had changed in that culture because you adapt things from other cultures into your culture. For example, even food. Some of the food that was in India wasn't available in East Africa. So your diet changes. Your music, you incorporate some of the local African musical instruments into your music. Your clothing changes. And once you moved here, so the culture is ever changing. But with the religion, there are more freedoms here than we ever had anywhere else.
Could you say just a little bit about this, another aspect of this, which I'm familiar with, that you've been thinking about a good deal? Would you say a little bit about how the Ismaili community is culturally quite pluralistic? It's not one-dimensional. It's not simply the kind of cultural formation that Azim had. And so the Ismaili community at this point here is engaged in trying to do a number of things with Ismailis, common religion, but profoundly distinct culture from a variety of parts of the world.
Right.
So what's happening even locally around that? Just say a little bit about that.
The Ismaili community is very small. We're about 10 million around the world.
Norwegians are small. We're 5 million. Ismailis are large from our perspective.
And 10 million Ismailis living in 25 different countries. We have a large population of Ismailis in Afghanistan, mostly Hazaras. We have a large Ismaili population in Tajikistan. We have a large Ismaili population in China, who we haven't met yet. Okay. ever since the trouble in Afghanistan, the Ismaili community in Edmonton sponsored and brought about 7,000 Ismailis from Afghanistan to Canada. And culturally, language, I mean, they're very different than we are. Also, the religious practices were very different than ours. So, over the last 15 years that they've been here, we've had a lot of challenges as to, you know, working with them. They came from straight from a war zone into Canada. Some of these children were born in tents and lived in tents for the first 10 years of their lives. They'd never been in a house. You know, the first few days when we brought some of these people and put them in a three-bedroom condominium, everybody would sleep in the kitchen together. They wouldn't sleep on their beds. They weren't accustomed to that. So we've had challenges, and because, you know, Ismailis are from different parts of the world, the pluralistic, the idea of pluralism is very, very strong in our community, that yes, we are all Ismailis who believe in the same thing, but we all do things differently, and therefore we respect each other's differences and we allow the differences. So we used to, in our East Indian tradition, we used to, our hymns were called Ginans. So we would recite Ginans in Jamaat Khana that were mostly composed in East Indian languages. When the Afghanis came here, they were reciting Qasidas, which were in Farsi. So a language we didn't know, a tradition we didn't know about. But today, we're very comfortable with Qasidas. We've learned them. We recite them with our Afghani Ismailis. And they've learned Ginans, and so it's been a wonderful experience. But there were a lot of challenges.
How does the Ismaili community fit in the larger community, Muslim community in Edmonton?
How does the Ismaili community fit in the larger community, the larger Muslim communities in Edmonton?
Challenging. Ismailis are part of the Shia tradition. So in the Muslim world, 1.3 billion Muslims, 15% of them are Shias. So the other 85% say the Shias are all heretic. They're wrong. They're doing everything wrong. Now within the Shias, we are a minority again. So we're, you know, we've had a lot of challenges, but because we have also a lot of ability to do a lot of things, we worked really well with the Muslim community. You know, the chair that was set, Islamic studies chair set up at the university, majority of the money for that came from the Ismaili community. We've been part of that, supporting that. So we try very hard to work with people who want to accept us. But if people just say, no, you know, we went to Cairo a few years ago, and the Ismaili Imam had built the first university in the world, the Al-Azhar University.
And we 1,000 years ago.
Yeah. We were in Al-Azhar Mosque and met the Imam of the mosque and said we were Ismailis. You know, and he said, well, he says, the Fatimids were very good builders, but very bad Muslims.
Could you comment on that large cultural development in Egypt and what has happened since the problem in the last several months?
Could you just hold that for 1 minute? I feel compelled to add a little footnote to this. Two things that I really want you all to know and appreciate. One is that since the Ismailis have come to Edmonton, to this part of the world,
they have played a singular role in trying to bring the whole of the Muslim community in Edmonton into a new kind of relationship to each other and to the public. And the other part of it is the Ismailis, in part because of what you've heard this morning, had a civil vision, which I think is very distinct in the contemporary, with contemporary Muslim communities in this part of the world. And it's a civil vision that I think is maybe beginning, but one would hope would become infectious within the Muslim communities as well, in order to do that work, not only within one's own community, not only within Muslim communities in general, but also within the civil sphere. So I think it's been a, you know, we have this biblical image of yeast in the loaf, and certainly from my perspective, the Ismailis have been an extremely life-giving yeast in the in this part of the world and for the Muslim community. So, we'll go back to Jane.
Well, I don't know much about... Well, first of all, I think the entire Arab Spring thing is wonderful. It's very good. What will come out of it immediately may not be what we like. But any democracy... I mean, if you look at the French Revolution... when they got rid of the kings, well, the first few years, things were not very good. Thousands of people were beheaded. And,
Madame Guillotine.
You know? But over time, you got good government. And I think we have to allow that to the Arab communities. But just on a slightly different note, in Cairo, the Aga Khan Development Network has built the largest green space in all of Middle East. There's a 30-hectare Al-Azhar Park built in Cairo, the first park that's ever been built there. And today, if you go to Cairo, that is the center of cultural activities. Thousands of people you see every day walking through that park. This is where people come and meet. We're building a Islamic garden at the University of Alberta, at the Devonian Garden. There's an Islamic park going to be built in Toronto with the Jamaat Khana. But a lot of cultural activities happening around the world.
Did you see the... there was an interview with Condoleezza Rice in the last couple of days. You probably didn't see it because you're all so much more committed than I am to particular television stations, whereas I, you know, because of the Ronning Center, I have to surf. So I found myself on a station named for a particular kind of animal, which we will not mention in this circle. And it was held at Columbia University, and it was a particular person from this station who I really don't know, but who has a reputation I'm familiar with. And he was holding a kind of public conversation in this liberal den called Columbia University. Actually, it was Mr. Hannity, whoever he might be, with Condoleezza Rice. And he raised exactly this question. And I suspect raised it from a perspective where he really sees the Arab Spring as dangerous. This is going to bring forth all kind of militant Muslims, and the Wahhabists are going to take over the world. It was really interesting to listen to Condi engage him. Because this, of course, is the territory. I mean, they support her. They think she and Bush were great. You know what she said? She said to him, Mr. Hannity, we must support democratic movements, as messy as they are. And you cannot expect that this is not going to be messy for quite some time. But look at what happens if we don't. And look at what has happened because we haven't sooner. I was astonished to hear her so clear and push back so thoroughly. And she said, the president, Obama, has done this superbly. And we must take the risk. There is no alternative.
So I was surprised at this.
But also,
I thought it was an interesting, telling moment.
But also understanding the role of religion in democracy. Look at our democracies. There is a lot of Christian thought in our democracies. You know, the right, the respect of a human being, and all these things. So the church in early democracy, you know, the idea played a very important role. Now, we only understand militant Islam here, but there are a lot of forces there that actually want proper human rights and all those things to happen. And that voice is not heard in the West, but it is heard loud and clear in the Arab countries.
And it was a profoundly suppressed voice.
Yes.
In the virulent secular dictatorships that have been the dominant ones and that have been falling like dominoes, whether it's Turkey or Iraq. I mean, these places have had very virulent forms of secular government, and those have been supported precisely because of the kind of ideology that comes from Mr. Hannity, as well as from the left. A penny has to drop here. But it's going to be messy.
Yeah. Because there are no institutions, the civil society institutions have been missing in all these Arab countries. And they will, as they develop, I think things will get better.
I was wanting to hearken back to this dialogue with the Métis and wondering, on one side you have the Ismailis bringing possibilities to the Métis, sounds like. What place and what factor or how valuable would it be, or is it, I'm not sure what's going on, for the Métis themselves to tell Indian and Northern Affairs, this is what we want. Can you change your policies to allow this to happen over a longer period of time than what you have typically allowed for? Is that going on at all, that is, with the community telling the government, we want this?
I don't know.
No.
I really don't know. You know, we keep reading about all these native areas with their councils being given certain amount of money to run the councils. For my children and for your children, grandchildren, to go to school, it is compulsory. It is the law in Canada that we have to send our children to school. Yet, a lot of native kids are not sent to school. So, what is the problem there? Right? Why? Why is there a separate law for you and I and a different law for them? Is it a different law, or is it how we look at things?
What strikes me as remarkable about this story is that the Ismaili community is extraordinarily diverse, as you just pointed out, economically, socially, culturally, in lots of ways, and yet they have a strong, cohering principle.
And leadership.
It is the strong, cohering principle that makes it possible for the community to be as influential as it is all around the world. Could you say a little something about that?
Yes. That is because of the Aga Khan. Mm-hmm. The imams of the Ismailis over the last 1400 years, but particularly the last 150 years, have worked very, very closely with all the governments where the Ismailis live, where they're allowed to work closely with them. And also, the type of work that the imamate has been doing around the world, from building, you know, there are schools that are built, for example, in Mombasa, There is a school there called the Aga Khan Academy, which would be as good as any private school anywhere in the Western world. Less than 3% of children going there are Ismailis. The other 97% are the local people from Mombasa area, Christians and Muslims. So there is a lot of work of that kind being done around the world. And this really comes from the Abrahamic tradition principles of charity. That, you know, the betterment of all of humanity, not just your own people, but every human being is God's child. And every human being deserves the best we can give them. So you begin to do a lot of these things, and, you know, as the community has become affluent and the connections with the governments around the world have got better, more and more money is being able to be spent on projects like this around the world. And you get partnerships. So for every dollar we raise in Canada, CEDA will give us either 50 cents or sometimes a dollar, sometimes $2, depending on the project. But there is a partnership there. There's a partnership with USAID. There's a partnership with, you know, the British government and different governments around the world. In the Western world, the German government is very supportive, and the Japanese government, the Bill Gates Foundation. But you work with all these different foundations to achieve what is, what needs to be done as human beings, right? If I can just digress and tell a very short story of, you know, in the African cultures, and my grandfather was a great collector of stories, and they all have stories of creation. Different African cultures have different stories of creation. But one of my favorite stories of creation was that God created mankind and then gathered mankind and said, I'm going to send you to your home. And before you go to your home, there's a huge tree behind you. And the name of the tree is the sorrow tree. And there are fruits for each one of you. So I want you to go and pick a fruit from that tree and then come back and assemble here again. So when people went around the tree, there were fruits of different sizes. There were real tiny fruits and there were really huge fruits. So people picked different fruits and they came and stood in front of God again. And so God asked people who had picked the largest fruits, why did you pick the largest fruit? They said, well, God, you told us it was a sorrow tree. And we looked around and we thought we were stronger than other people, so we took a larger share of that. God said to these people, when you go to your home where I'm going to send you, you're going to have miserable lives, people who have picked the large fruits. And people who had picked the tiniest fruits, God said, you're going to have privileged lives. But you're going to have privileged lives because somebody else took your share of the sorrow. God then said, one day you're all coming back to my house. And when you come back to my house, I'm going to ask you one question. What did you do for that person who took your share of the sorrow?
Another great story.
Another great story.
I can't understand why you're a bad Muslim.
I'm not.
No, in the community when you said,
well,
you know, we're not accepted. And so I just, can you just help me understand that a little bit?
It's really to do with historic reasons that, you know, at the birth of Islam, there was a group of people who believed based on some verses in the Quran and based on what Prophet Muhammad said, that the succession of the community would now be passed to his son-in-law Ali, and thereafter there would be an imam, and that imam would always be from the Prophet's family. There were political reasons that Abu Bakr wanted to become the caliph, and therefore Ali was not made the leader of the community. And
Abu Bakr was a companion of the Prophet,
and his
Ali was a relative.
And Aisha was married to, his daughter Aisha was married to the Prophet. So there was a ideological shift that Abu Bakr started to say, well, we don't need anyone from the Prophet's family, because the Quran and the example of what the Prophet has left, the example is called the Sunnah, is more than enough for us to continue. So they were known as the Sunnis, and people who followed Ali were called people, party of Ali, so Shia. So there was a split between the Shias and the Sunnis, and the Sunnis went on to become more powerful over time, and
bigger empires,
and Shias, you know, the only empire they had was in Iran, and the Ismailis for a while had the Fatimid Empire in Egypt for a couple hundred years, and in Iran for a very short time.
It seems to me all this good work that you do might convince folks that you're not bad.
Well, I mean, you know, the Taliban come and burn our vehicles in Afghanistan from time to time, come and bomb our offices from time to time, and yet, you know, the Aga Khan Development Network is the largest taxpayer in Afghanistan. We pay over $250 million taxes every year there. We've got, you know, we hire thousands of people in different things.
It's an old struggle, but doing the temperate.
Last year, to receive an honorary degree from the university, and I was so impressed by his speech that day because he spoke so eloquently about collaboration and partnerships, and he was in that business, so he spoke so excitedly about the work that the Ismaili community was doing, and exemplary. I was so impressed about it. If everybody could hear this, if everybody could take that model and sit at the table with that type of idea around partnership and collaboration, we would soar.
Yes. Thank you so much, Nazim. Thank you. Good to see you all.